Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the second module in the Discovering Buddhism, or second class in the Discovering Buddhism module on the spiritual teacher. Let's see, do we have anyone who's here tonight who wasn't here last week? Okay, a couple people, that's fine. I don't think you'll have any problems picking up where we are. Last week was we watched a video and did a little bit of meditation. Tonight we'll get more into discussion. And as I said last week, I'm keeping these sessions to an hour, 7 to 8, so people don't get zoomed out. But as always, we'll begin with our prayers. These help settle our mind after a maybe frantic day. And then we'll follow that with a little bit of meditation. The prayers are to help set our motivation. So Linda's going to bring those up. I'll read them. You can read along, but put yourself on mute if you do, because it creates some problems if we try and read together. So we'll do Refuge in Bodhicitta 3 times, the 4 Immeasurables, and the Short Mandala Offering. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. May all sentient beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May all sentient beings be inseparable from the happiness that is free from suffering. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from attachment for friends or hatred for enemies. This ground, anointed with perfume, strewn with flowers, adorned with Mount Meru, 4 continents, the sun and the moon. I imagine this as a Buddha field and offer it. May all living beings enjoy this pure land. Idam Guru Ratna Mandala Kam Niryatayami. And now we'll begin our meditation session. And please start by checking your posture. I'm going to assume that most people are sitting in a chair. You're not slumped back in the chair, but you're sitting straight. Your back a little bit straighter than you normally sit. Not rigid, but just a little bit more upright and not slumped. Head not tilted to one side or the other, maybe just a couple degrees in front of the vertical, but not drop down too much. Eyes either just slightly open, so a little bit of light comes in, or lightly closed, but not clenched. Mouth lightly closed, lips touching. Tongue on the gum above the backside of our upper teeth. Shoulders down, relaxed, and a little bit back so that our chest is open. Upper arms away from the sides of our body. Right hand on left with the thumbs touching just slightly below the navel. And our feet are flat on the floor. If we're sitting in a chair, it's fine to put a cushion under your feet. If you are sitting on a cushion, your feet are, your legs are crossed in a position that you find comfortable. And the whole point of the posture is not to be uncomfortable or to torture yourself, but it said that it opens certain energy channels that flow up and down in front of the spine that the consciousness travels on. So the posture helps free the consciousness from ordinary thought as we do our meditation. So check your posture and any sources of discomfort or tension. Address them now so they don't become a recurrent theme of your meditation. We could do 10 minutes of meditating on how uncomfortable my legs are, but that really doesn't accomplish a whole lot, to be honest with you. So if they're uncomfortable, address that now and get a posture that works for you. And we'll begin by taking 3 deep breaths from the abdomen, the stomach expanding on the in-breath, so our diaphragm is pulled down, and then contracting towards the spine on the out-breath. So just do that 3 times. And now we allow our breathing to return to its normal pattern. And we start our meditation session by setting our motivation. We've already done that to some degree with the prayers. But now we think specifically about the bodhicitta motivation, the wish to become enlightened for the benefit of others. The thought that I am doing this meditation to develop my mind, to develop its capacity for wisdom and compassion so that I can become fully enlightened, not for my own sake, but for the benefit of all sentient beings. And that's not a way we normally think, or most of us don't. So if it seems a little bit artificial or forced, that's okay. But just think that way for a moment. I want to become enlightened so that I can benefit others. The bodhicitta, great mind motivation. And having set our motivation, we begin the actual meditation practice, a simple concentration meditation. The chosen object is the movement of the breath, the physical sensation of air moving in and out through the openings of our nostrils. Just that slightly cool, tactile sensation. We place our awareness on that. And every time our awareness wanders off to a thought, a memory, or an itch, or a regret, or a plan for what we're doing tomorrow, we just set that aside and gently come back to the breath over and over and over again. And that's the meditation practice. And we'll do that for about 8 minutes. Thank you. And we can end our meditation with a brief dedication. We can acknowledge that we've done something a little bit out of the ordinary. We made a deliberate choice to sit this evening in meditation and develop a little bit of concentration. And that's a positive action. It's made a positive imprint, positive in the sense that it leads to happiness. And we think, may that imprint not be lost, but may it ripen in the future in a way that benefits all sentient beings. So just think along those lines for a moment. And you can relax your concentration. Do we have any questions specifically about that meditation or comments before we get into the material for this evening?
If anyone does, you can simply unmute and ask your question or type it in the chat or wave.
And I'll leave some time at the end for questions tonight, okay? So this class is on the spiritual teacher, which is one of the most, I think, misunderstood topics in all of Buddhism. We hear a lot about gurus and lamas and root gurus, and it can sound very mystical and not part of our experience and even very off-putting at times. So if nothing else during these evenings we have together, I want to kind of demystify this whole process, because you have people showing up at Kadampa Center for the very first time, and they're convinced that they have to find a root guru within a week or something, or their spiritual practice is lacking in meaning. And that's not at all the way to go. So we're talking about teachers, and we've all had experience of wonderful teachers in other areas, and some of us have had the experience of wonderful Buddhist teachers also. And I think it helps to start off by just thinking about the different types of teachers we may encounter as we progress along our spiritual path or as we study Buddhism. As I mentioned last week, each of us has different needs, is looking for something different. Our relationship with teachers or our lack of relationship with teachers is going to be completely individual, and that's perfectly okay. There's no party line you have to follow in terms of relating to teachers or finding teachers. Most of us who study Buddhism for more than maybe one DV module have multiple teachers during our as we progress along our spiritual path. They will each be unique individuals. Our relationship with each one will be different. The teachers will have different levels of education and attainment themselves. And they will relate to different students in different ways. We won't see a teacher relating to each of his students in every way. People who have been around in the FPMT, our organization, for a long time may have some knowledge of Lama Yeshe, who is who founded the FPMT back in the 70s. And you may have seen videos of him, and he's always laughing and giggling and making jokes. And then you hear these stories from Lama's longtime students who would have one-on-one sessions, and they said he was absolutely ferocious with them. So he was relating to the students in the mass teachings in a very different way from he might relate to a student one-on-one. As one of his students said, I can't remember, said, man, he was a heavy Lama. But you wouldn't get that at all if you watch the many videos that are still being shown on the FPMT website. So teachers relate to students differently. students relate to teachers differently. There's no perfect teacher for every student. There's no perfect student for each teacher. So just start from that ground point, and we'll look at some of the different sorts of teachers we may encounter. I mean, the first and most simplest, or the most one level of teacher, I'm not going to say simplest because they're highly educated, we may just meet an academic teacher of Buddhism. We may take a course in comparative religions in college or something. And this is someone who is just giving us the facts about Buddhism without necessarily bringing any personal experience of the teachings to the table. And that's a perfectly valid student-teacher relationship if that's what we're looking for. And I know we have people who take these modules and come to Kadampa Center, and that's all they want, just the facts, please, ma'am, as Jack Webb would say. You know, they just want to learn some cold, hard facts about Buddhism as compared to other religions. So that's a very simple level of student-teacher relationship. Now, beyond that, we may come to what we could call a Dharma instructor. I think most of the people who lead these Discovering Buddhism modules would fall into that category. Those of us who teach this have some knowledge of Buddhism, both its history and its basic core tenets. Maybe less than an academic teacher, actually. A lot of us are kind of spotty in what we know about the history of Buddhism and haven't really studied it from an academic point of view. But we do have some knowledge of the Dharma. That's the term that's used to apply to the teachings of the Buddha, the teachings given by the historical Buddha 2,500 years ago and as brought down in a continuous lineage through teachers to teachers that we've had. So we're people who have received teachings from other teachers who are far more knowledgeable than we are. We've studied the teachings, and we've tried to put them into practice in our own lives. We have some personal experience of the teachings. We think that this is the path that we have chosen, and we choose it to share it with others who are interested. So that's someone who could be called a Dharma instructor. But again, that's a fairly low-key sort of relationship. The relationship between a student and a Dharma instructor. Then we also may encounter what we could call meditation instructors. Okay, this is people who have practiced specific meditation techniques and have great experience of that. They may not have a tremendous amount of Dharma knowledge. Okay, but you'll have some people who kind of specialize in meditation practice, and they can teach that practice to you based on their personal experience. Or they may have some specific understanding, and this is something you'll see a lot in Tibetan circles, some knowledge of a specific ritual that you're interested in learning. So you may have a ritual instructor, again, who is not teaching you a whole lot of the Dharma, but is teaching you specifics about certain rituals. And Geshe Sampo at Kadampa Center, though he's not just a ritual instructor, has had a lot of teachings on various rituals, and that's is one of his areas of expertise. So he gives teachings on rituals. He functions as a ritual teacher. So these are all pretty straightforward sort of relationships. There's nothing really out of the ordinary about these relationships. Then next step, we can enter into what we think of as the spiritual mentors. And this is a higher level of interaction between the student and the teacher. And typically we think of the spiritual mentor or the lama or the guru. Those are terms we may use, though they're used somewhat informally, as someone from whom primarily we would take vows, okay? And there are different levels of vows that we take in Tibetan Buddhism. The first level is it's not really a set of vows, but it's what's called the refuge ceremony, which means acknowledging that the Buddha, the historical figure of the Buddha, the Dharma, his teachings, and the Sangha, the spiritual community, are your source of refuge on your spiritual path. And this is a specific ceremony. It's offered at Kadampa Center maybe once a year, once every other year. It's offered by Geshe Gelug. It's also offered by visiting teachers. You take this as a kind of entry into a serious spiritual path. It's a ceremony you go through one time, and the teacher that you take it from needs to be someone that you respect, someone that you have some knowledge of, someone that you've checked out to a certain degree. It doesn't need to be for years, but you've come to their teachings and found that they speak to you. And that is your refuge mentor or your refuge guru. And that creates a sort of spiritual bond. This may not be your primary teacher on your spiritual path, but that is an important student-teacher relationship, taking refuge. The next set of vows, or the first set of vows, is what we call the lay vows, the pratimoksha vows. These are the vows of ethical conduct, not to steal, lie, drink intoxicants, sexual misconduct. What's the one I'm leaving out? There's one more. Anyway, there are five of them. I'm blanking on one of them. The steal, lie, intoxicants, sexual misconduct.
Kill.
Okay. Take a vow not to steal, not to lie, not to kill, not to use intoxicants or mind-altering substances, not to commit sexual misconduct. And these are what are referred to as the lay, L-A-Y, or pratimoksha vows. And these are vows that are typically offered with the refuge ceremony, but you don't have to take them at the refuge ceremony. And the question that Westerners always have is, do I have to take all five, or can I pick and choose amongst these? And most teachers, most Tibetan teachers say it's fine to pick and choose the ones that you take. Most people set the one to use intoxicants aside for at least a while. You take them with the understanding that you're not going to be able to keep them perfectly, but that you can take them over and over and renew them and purify those ones that you have broken, because most of them you will break at some point. It's hard to go a lifetime and keep these vows. So that is your refuge mentor or refuge preceptor that you take those from. It can be the same teacher who gives you the refuge ceremony, takes you through the refuge ceremony, or maybe someone different. You may decide to go through the refuge ceremony, but not take the vows and take them at another point in time. Again, that establishes a strong connection between you and the teacher that you take your pratimoksha vows from. Okay, the next level of vows is what's called the bodhisattva vows. The bodhisattva vows are the vows that we take to help us develop bodhicitta. A bodhisattva, a great being, is someone who has completely developed bodhicitta, the great mind, the mind that wishes to become enlightened for the benefit of others. That every action, that is the motivation. From getting up in the morning, brushing your teeth, drinking your coffee, to lying down at night. Everything is done so that I can become enlightened, so I can benefit others. The person who has completely realized that, for whom that is constant in their mind stream, is called a bodhisattva. And that's not the same as a Buddha, but it's a very great step on the path to Buddhahood, which is complete enlightenment, completely developing our qualities of compassion and wisdom. So the Bodhisattva is someone who has really made tremendous progress on the compassion wing towards enlightenment. This is about developing compassion, everything to relieve others of suffering. So to help develop that quality, we take what are called the Bodhisattva vows. And this is it's a long list. There are primary Bodhisattva vows and secondary Bodhisattva vows. There are about 45 altogether, and they're quite complex. And some of them are hard to understand. Some are quite simple. But it's mainly about avoiding harming others and helping them when we have the opportunity. First, avoiding harming others. Next, help them when that's a possibility. And again, these are taken with the understanding that you're not going to keep them perfectly. Okay? We tend to think of vows as a fence around us, and that's not really the way that we should approach them in Buddhism. They're really an aid, something to help us develop qualities that we aspire to. Okay, so we can call the teacher that we take the Bodhisattva vows from as our Mahayana master. And if people are our Mahayana mentor, if people are not familiar with the term Mahayana, that's the type of Buddhism that we practice. There's the Hinayana, which is more Southeastern Asia, where the aspiration is towards personal enlightenment and a state of nirvana. In the Mahayana tradition, the aspiration is towards complete Buddhahood with compassion and wisdom completely developed. So someone that we take the Bodhisattva vows from, using a lot of words here, it can be thought of as our Mahayana master. Okay? And then the next stage of a teacher that we may encounter or may find that we need on our spiritual path is what we call the tantric teacher, the teacher from whom we take the tantric vows. And these are the highest level of vows. They're typically given in concert with a tantric initiation, which is a specialized form of meditation, typically using the image of a deity that you see on the tankas at Kadampa Center. It's given by a qualified master along with the tantric vows. And these tantric practices that we are initiated into by the master are to speed us on our path to enlightenment. And there are various meditation practices, and you take a vow to do them daily or three times daily or things like this. And that's the highest level of the student-teacher relationship. And this is where it really gets into, we are seeing the teacher not just as a human being whom we admire and respect and enjoy being around, but we, as much as possible, we see them as the complete incarnation of the teachings of the Buddha. They are our direct conduit to the teachings of the Buddha. Okay, we see them as having all these qualities of compassion and wisdom that make up enlightenment and that we aspire to ourselves. So this is really based on very close and careful observation and thought about who you want to take this sort of vows from. Because as you see, as you can easily imagine, it has the possibility for disaster if you take it from someone who is really not well qualified to assume this position. And there are a lot of student-teacher relationships you can find all over the internet that have been problematic and disastrous for student and teacher. Because when you enter into that sort of relationship with a teacher, seeing them as representing the Buddha. Not just giving the teachings, but being the actual qualities of the Buddha. You're really opening yourself up very wide. And so you have to be very careful. So that's the tantric student-teacher relationship. The most advanced, the rarest, but the most powerful also. So we may have, as you can see, we can have different relationships with different teachers. The tantric master is not necessarily the person that we took refuge with. We may take tantric vows from multiple teachers. Okay, we only take refuge from one teacher. We take the pratimoksha vows from one teacher, but we can take the bodhisattva vows from multiple teachers. And we can have dharma teachers and ritual instructors and meditation teachers. So if we spend time on the Buddhist path, if we look at it, initially maybe just starting academically and decide this is the way for us, we're going to have different teachers as we progress along the path. Our relationship with each of them is going to be different, and they may change over time. As we progress along the path, we need to be increasingly careful about establishing these relationships. And we need to understand that we're going to get different value out of each relationship. You know, you may take tantric vows if you're at that level from a teacher that you see once in your lifetime. You may take the tantric vows and never actually physically see them again. But every time you do the practice, you are, in a way, communicating them. You may take tantric vows in a stadium with His Holiness the Dalai Lama, and there are 10,000 other people there, and most of them will not do the practice, and most of them will never see them again. But for you, it may be an incredibly meaningful ceremony. Another phrase that we hear is, sometimes you hear people talk about their root guru or their root lama, and that's the teacher that you have the strongest connection with, the one who inspires you the most, the one whom you see as the embodiment of what you want to be, the one who is your role model, the one who you really have that strong connection with. And this is just something that you decide on your own. You don't go up, you know, the teacher doesn't come up, typically does not come up to you and say, I'm your root guru. This is something that you become aware of over time. Most commonly, it's going to be someone that you take tantric vows with, but that's not a requirement. Okay, so it's a kind of a loose term, but you will hear people say, so-and-so is my root guru. It's not really something you need to go around bragging about, but it's not something that you need to, that you have to have right away or at any certain point on the path. Okay? So there are all these different types of teachers. Your relationship with them all is going to be completely different. Do we have any questions or comments now?
We do have a question from Kelly S., and she asks, personal enlightenment and nirvana, is that Zen Buddhism?
Okay. You got a couple terms there. Okay, Zen Buddhism is the type of Buddhism practiced in Japan. Philosophically, it is very similar to Tibetan Buddhism, Chinese Buddhism, several others. Those are the Mahayana tradition. Okay, the Hinayana tradition are the Vietnamese and the Buddhists of Southeast India, typically. So you have Hinayana and Mahayana, Zen Buddhism, Tibetan Buddhism, Chinese Buddhism are the main types of Mahayana Buddhism. In Hinayana traditions, the aspiration is towards personal freedom from suffering, okay? Liberation from suffering, which means they talk about a state of nirvana, complete freedom from suffering and, to some degree, a state of non-existence. I am not an expert on Hinayana Buddhism, Okay, so don't take anything I say about that as word. But the aspiration is nirvana, personal liberation. All of the Mahayana traditions, Zen, Tibetan, Chinese, the goal is enlightenment or the state of Buddhahood, okay, which means not just freedom from suffering, which basically is development of wisdom, okay? Development of wisdom is how we free ourselves from suffering, but aligned with compassion, the wish that others be free of suffering. So there are two components of enlightenment or Buddhahood, wisdom and compassion. In the Mahayana traditions, the goal is to maximize both of those, okay? And Zen is a subset of Mahayana. All the different Buddhist traditions have a lot of cultural attachments. That's why Zen, you know, very austere or comparatively austere, a lot of silence. Tibetan, the gaudier the better, you know, lots of colors and noise and bells and all this, and Chinese somewhere in between. You know, a lot of that is cultural, okay? But philosophically, those types are very similar. Does that answer your question? I hope that answers the question.
There's a follow-up that Kelly has. Indian, Vietnamese, Korean is Hinayana.
Yeah, there's not a lot of Buddhism in India currently, even though Buddhism started in northern India and then it was replaced by Hinduism. But the Korean, the Vietnamese, Cambodian, okay, those are the Hinayana traditions. Okay, so let's see. We talked enough about teachers for a little bit. Let's talk about students. Okay. What makes a good student? I know we all think of ourselves as good students, but what's a good student for someone who's on the Buddhist path? Getting the sun starting to go down. A little dark here. Okay. It said that the Buddha gave us certain qualities that are optimal as a student to bring to the teachings. We may possess some of them already. We may be completely lacking some of them. But these are good qualities, he said, as a student, and we can work on developing them if we don't have them. And as always, if people are... if people are new to Tibetan Buddhism, they love lists. There's always lists. So there's three of this and five of that, and this is a seven list, okay? So the first quality of a good student is open-mindedness, okay, which doesn't mean blank-mindedness or apathy or being completely blown around by the winds, but an open mind. Okay, not rejecting anything that's presented automatically. Okay, an open mind. Okay, able to hear different ideas and evaluate them. The second quality is common sense, the ability to differentiate between what makes sense and what doesn't make sense just from a very, basic level. I mean, you've heard, you hear horrible stories about various so-called teachers who have their students do horrible things, you know, sleep with the teacher or, you know, get drunk or things. You know, that's maybe the student lacked common sense. I can't say that, but a basic sense of what's right and wrong, of what's virtuous and non-virtuous. Okay. Another quality is an interest in the Dharma, an interest in the teachings of the Buddha. So this is for a Buddhist student, obviously, a strong interest in the Buddha and in finding a properly qualified teacher. The next quality is respect for the Dharma. and for well-qualified teachers. You know, it doesn't mean you have to grovel before them, but a certain, you know, willingness to acknowledge this is someone who has studied and has developed their mind and has certain positive qualities that I respect. And in the way I respect the teachings of the Buddha. It doesn't mean you accept everything on faith. It doesn't mean that you believe everything that you hear, but you have a respect for what they have to say. The next quality is an attentive mind, an ability to pay attention to what the teacher is offering. The next quality, and again, these are optimal qualities, and we may not have these at all times in our life, a degree of emotional maturity and stability. You know, if we're in the midst of a great psychological or psychiatric crisis, you know, that may not be the best time to try and listen to the teachings, or it may be difficult. Okay, it doesn't mean we have to be perfectly happy or everything, but we need a certain amount of stability to appreciate the teachings. And then the last quality is a basic sense of ethics, of what's right and wrong. And in Buddhism, ethics basically refers to not harming others. Okay, so understanding that our actions, as much as possible, need to be ethical. Okay, so open-mindedness, common sense, interest in the Dharma, respect for the Dharma and the teachings, ability to pay attention, some emotional stability, and a sense of ethics. Okay, those are the optimal qualities of a student. That's, and like I say, we may have them at certain times, we may not. That's okay. But we're always, you know, the teachings we should always approach with an open mind, but also a questioning mind. The teachings should always be approached of, how does this measure against my own experience? They say we should approach the teachings like a metallurgist who analyzes minerals and to see if it's gold or not. Okay? We're not rejecting it, saying immediately there's no gold there, but we have to look at it and analyze it. And no matter how much we respect the teacher and the teachings, we should always bring that open-minded questioning, okay? Not doubting, not rejecting out of hand, but always questioning. And if something seems wrong, maybe not reject it right away, but set it aside. Or if it just makes no sense, set it aside. Don't take anything on blind faith just because someone says so. That's very important. You know, that's our common sense that they refer to in the second one. Any questions or comments here? Okay. Let's finish up with another meditation. Okay. So again, establish your posture. I think you're familiar with that. Starting with your back and then working down. Establish the posture. Identify any areas of tension. Three deep breaths from the abdomen. That's your motivation, the bodhicitta motivation. Now a couple minutes of breathing meditation, awareness, concentration on the physical movement of air in and out through the nostrils. And now I'd like you to just go through the list of the seven qualities, optimal qualities of a student: open-mindedness, common sense, interest in the Dharma, respect for the Dharma and the teachings, an attentive mind, emotional stability, and a sense of ethics. And just think, which of these qualities do I have? Which do I maybe lack to some degree? How would it benefit me to develop those qualities? Not to criticize yourself, but just the acknowledgement that none of us is a perfect student. How, when I find a qualified teacher, can I get more benefit from that relationship? What quality could I bring to it? And you can end your meditation with a brief dedication. Okay. So next week, we're going to be talking about qualities that we look for in the teacher. How do we find a teacher who's appropriate for us? What should we be looking for, particularly as we progress along the spiritual path? We need to be very careful. So we'll talk about those qualities. And in preparation for that, I'd like you to meditate for six days again this week. Set your motivation. Do 5 minutes of concentration meditation. And then while still in that concentrated state, I'd like you to bring to mind wonderful teachers that you've had in your lifetime. And they don't have to be Buddhist teachers at all. I mean, I bring to mind my sixth grade biology teacher, my organic teacher and organic professor in chemistry, and my first horseback riding teacher. Those are the three that come to mind. But don't just say, oh, yeah, wonderful teacher. Try, do a little bit of analysis. What qualities did those people have that made them good teachers for you, made them great teachers? And try and be really specific with that and analytic and say, why did I have this connection with that person? So 5 minutes after the concentration meditation, think along those lines, do your dedication. We'll be together next week and we'll talk about the list of qualities we look for in a spiritual teacher. And anything else, Linda?
Nope, I think that's it.
Okay, and bring your questions next week. And we'll be here from 7 to 8 next week. The week after is July 5th, and there's no class that night. And we'll pick up the Monday afterwards. Okay, thank you, Linda. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you so much, Robbie.
Okay, good night.